Okay, very quickly before we begin, I started kind of journaling my newsletter consumption this morning. So here, this takes me up to 10 a.m. Are you ready? Begins with Heather Cox Richardson, whom you will meet in the second segment of today's show, which is about newsletters. I'll skip over her for now. Next up in my inbox is Wunderkind Gabe Fleischer, who is also on the show today. He's got a crisply written account of a shift in the Biden administration's vaccine strategy, a recap of the Liz Cheney war, and his daybook, which tells you what the White House players are doing. First Gentleman Doug Emhoff will tour a manufacturing incubator in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in case you were wondering what he's doing today. Next, Kendall Baker's terrific sports newsletter for Axios, which I love because I don't really have time to follow sports the way I used to. Did you know there's a new NHL franchise called the Seattle Kraken, as in Release the Kraken, and that they will play in Climate Pledge Arena, which bills itself as the most progressive, responsible, and sustainable arena in the world? I didn't know any of that. Next up, Eric Bollard. He's been on the show. He's usually really, really mad at the mainstream media for false equivalency between right-wing bullies and normal politicians. Today is a really long piece about Murdoch in Australia. Oh, no, Greg Mitchell is just clocked in. I love his newsletter. Without really knowing who he is, I thought for a while he was the Talking Points memo guy, but that's Josh Marshall. A favorite Greg Mitchell feature is the previous, it's a melange his of humor and politics and obsession about rock and roll. But one of the things he does that I like is he has some of the jokes from the previous day in The Onion, the Andy Borowitz late night. Apparently it's okay to joke about Melinda and Bill Gates' divorce. So Jimmy Fallon said, Melinda Gates is thinking, finally, I can use a MacBook. And Jimmy Kimmel said, poor Bill Gates, he's been sleeping in his jet. It's very sad. And finally, on to Mark Slutsky, whose Something Good newsletter. I don't know how I would describe this, but among today's fascinations, there's an asteroid named after Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa, Duke of Palma and the last prince of Lampedusa, who was an Italian nobleman who wrote a really famous novel called Il Gattopardo, the Leopard. But he's like, and then he didn't write any other novels. That was just sort of it. So anyway, that was how many newsletters I'd read as of 10 a.m. More are on the way. I got The Tangle later. The author of that's going to be on with us. And Rusty Foster's Indispensable Today in Tabs will probably come to my inbox around 2. And I also have to write my own newsletter for Hearst. But so what's going on here? We're having a newsletter moment. Here to help us understand it is Ben Smith, who I'm a big fan of, and if he had a newsletter, I'd read it, but he's going to explain why he doesn't. Ben Smith is the media columnist for the New York Times, founding and former editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News. Welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me on.
So there's a newsletter moment going on. Newsletters aren't that new a form, but I'd say, maybe from late 2020 through the present moment, there's this huge boom going on. Famous names in journalism are moving over to Substack. Large amounts of money are being slung around. And this clearly is kind of, something's going on in journalism that is very, very much tied to newsletters. So what is going on?
Well, basically what's going on is that people have figured out a way to get paid for writing newsletters. It's always been very common, since the early days of email to subscribe to updates from somebody who was giving you the news of the day or their perspective or a roundup of links or, your crazy uncle just sharing his thoughts. But basically, across the whole internet, and if you subscribe to Spotify, if you subscribe to Netflix, if you subscribe to the New York Times, you may have noticed that it's just gotten a lot easier for people to take money, for people to take your money on the internet. And they're fairly, and it's not, and there's a couple of fairly simple to use platforms, the best known is Substack, where I can, where I can charge you for my newsletter without my having to, do anything technical to build anything interesting or build anything technically complicated. And so a whole generation of journalists and people who have, big followings and feel like they'd rather not be in the confines of a big institution are making, are starting to make a living at it.
Right. So, we can divide this into subgenres. I'm going to throw out, for the purposes of today's show, anything that's from a corporate entity. For example, this company that I work for, they put out a newsletter every day about everything going on in Connecticut public media. I don't think that those are the same or that interesting. But let's talk about one of the other subgenres. So one of the other subgenres are either famous or semi-famous journalists. We're talking Matt Taibbi, Andrew Sullivan, Glenn Greenwald, and CNN, Helen Peterson, who are either leaving or getting kicked out of somewhere else and coming to Substack. So can you say a little bit more about that? Like, what do you make of that?
Well, actually, I'd like to first just sort of pull the lens back a little bit just to make the point that this isn't really about journalism.
Okay.
Like, adult performers are doing this on OnlyFans. Musicians are doing it on Patreon. There's a possibility for individuals of all sorts to reach kind of their fans. And it's having a huge impact on all sorts of industries. But journalism is absolutely one. And I think, you know, for people who, for reasons of kind of personality or of their interests, would rather talk, you know, or because they think they could make more money at it, you know, are kind of breaking off from big institutions. Also, Momo and big institutions are sort of rife with internal politics and worried about getting into trouble on Twitter and with their audiences. And so if you're the sort of writer who likes to have huge fights on Twitter with people, or who is sort of not, is outside some the political consensus of the place you work, this is a way to go and not have to worry that you're going to get kind of a nervous email from your boss about the latest thing you tweeted.
Right. I mean, I think, aren't there two other ways to think about this? One of them is that traditional forms of media aren't in many cases doing as well, and newspapers are doing terribly right now, or at least the ones that aren't big, gigantic New York Times type ones are doing terribly right now. And within news organizations, there is, as you're suggesting, this kind of fly-specking of everybody's point of view, use of language. I mean, you can, you know, be drummed out of your job for something you said outside the work environment. If you're Don McNeil from the New York Times on a trip, as you know, as a chaperone on a student trip somewhere, something you said. So it does seem to me that some of the more restless intellects, you know, the people who bridle at that kind of thing, they seem very, very attracted to this. And in many cases, if it's like Andrew Sullivan, his regular gig dried up kind of for connected reasons, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's basically a bunch of kind of left wingers who aren't mostly, Andrew's not that, but others who are basically their politics are on the left, but they disagree pretty strongly with some element of the kind of current consensus around particularly racial justice. But, and it's really complicated, and I don't want to sort of overly characterize people's point of view, but they want to have fights about issues that a lot of big institutions right now are very much on eggshells about. And so they just are going straight to their audiences.
Although,
that's not the only reason to do it, though. It's also, I mean, Anne Helen Peterson, who you mentioned, is a really interesting example of a really kind of gifted culture writer who I think is really interested in having like kind of like calmer conversations with a community of people who are really interested in her work rather than fighting on social media with idiots who hate her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the other thing. It's a way to sort of like, I'm not just writing this thing to kind of fling out onto the internet and have whoever read it. And many of them misinterpret it or hate the headline or decide they don't like it based on the person you're writing about. But instead, it's like I've gathered my group of a few thousand people who I know are really interested in this work, who I'm having kind of a running conversation with. And you can do a different kind of journalism when you are talking to people who you can kind of assume that they're in good faith, that they know where you're coming from, that they read your last piece. It's a very different and kind of, I think, quite satisfying kind of journalism.
I can verify that. And, you know, McLuhan said the tool shapes the user. And I think that's also true of newsletters. I mean, I have my own daily radio show here. I have a column for Hearst, but I'm writing a newsletter. And I found that after I'd written it for 6 months or so, I was writing a very, very different thing than I thought I was going to. And some of it, I think, is exactly the thing that you described. There's an elective quality to all of this. You decide to get somebody's newsletter. You get my newsletter and Helen Peterson's. And so already we've formed a kind of implied covenant, which is going to allow us to proceed on a different basis. That's basically what you're saying, right?
Yeah, that's right. You're writing for, right. You're not screaming at the top of your lungs to try to get attention over over everybody else on social media whose incentive is to have the most extreme thing to say. So I think on one hand, newsletters can sort of provide an outlet for politics that have been sort of drummed out of the mainstream in one way or the other. But I think they can also just provide kind of a quieter space almost to have a conversation.
Now, there obviously is some agita about what happens if a lot of really, really talented and kind of franchise names start leaving conventional legacy media outlets and to go off and make their own newsletters and collect their own revenue directly from the people who read. There's kind of a theory, a Substack theory, that writers at big organizations are underpaid compared to what they can get doing this. So I don't know. Should anybody be worried that, in fact, this is going to bleed talent out of already beleaguered journalistic institutions?
Well, I think, you know, the franchise is an interesting metaphor, right? I mean, I do think that, you know, there are these two things happening in media right now that are kind of tearing it apart. One of which is you have this very strong kind of union-driven movement in newsrooms to say, like, people ought to be paid equally. People doing the same work should make the same money. We should, you know, have like kind of the lowest paid people should be making that much less than the higher paid people, which I think most people in newsrooms feel like, yeah, that's just and that's right. And then on the other, you have the kind of dynamic you see in professional sports where the talent command a huge salary because they provide enormous value, and people and the audience is drawn more and more to the individual star rather than the kind of the faceless brand. And so, and you know, and a sort of star journalist, you know, maybe does think, well, everybody ought to be paid equally, but also might think, man, I'm bringing in a lot of revenue to this company, and why am I not being compensated proportionate to that? I think those things are really, really deeply in tension right now.
Yeah, no, I would agree. That's almost a separate conversation. So Substack obviously is the kind of Bigfoot right now of this. On the other hand, as you have written, possibly the big threat will be from other platforms. Some of the big media companies are trying to develop their own newsletter platforms or have done so. And then there's something called Ghost. Explain to people what Ghost is.
It's, you know, basically, and I mean, I think if any of your readers ever tried to set up a blog, there was a time when it was like really hard and technically hard to write on the internet. And then suddenly the bunch of services like Blogger came along that made it really easy. And you could just log in and start typing onto the internet. And what's happening with newsletters that charge money for subscriptions is that Substack was sort of the first one to make it easy. And they also have a lot of venture capital and paid big advances to some writers to get on there first. But increasingly, it's becoming a thing that is technically not that hard. Ghost is a service where for $9 a month, you can basically do the same thing. You can send a newsletter to a bunch of readers. You can charge them whatever you feel like. And you don't have to know anything about HTML. You don't have to code anything. It's very straightforward. And I think increasingly, it is going to be a thing just kind of anyone can do.
So there's also, I think, a sense here, you know, the internet has gone through a series of iterations. And people who are doing work in the digital universe, I think they're always kind of looking for the next Wild West. I see that in some of the newsletters. I see that in some of the writing about the newsletters, that people are looking for this space where, yeah, maybe they can do a little bit more of what they want. Or, Gawker and Deadspin and places, things like that were kind of exciting at one point. But Gawker, I guess you wrote that it's being revived or has been revived. But there's sort of that sense that there was sort of independent stuff that you could do with nobody looking over your shoulder. You could say what you want to say. You could be a flamethrower if you wanted to, and nobody would monkey with you. But then those imprints and those names started to get bought up by venture capitalists or big media companies, and you couldn't do that anymore. I'm assuming newsletters are a little bit of that too. Like I still want to have a Wild West saloon I can go into.
Oh, for sure. And if you sort of see the pendulum swing, you had all these people who were kind of bloggers in the aughts and the early teens, myself included, who then all kind of wound up working for these big media companies. And you know, and with all the positives and negatives that come with working for a big company, and I think are both they individually, people like Matt Iglesias and Andrew Sullivan and Glenn Greenwald, who were bloggers, and then just sort of writers in general are sort of like, you know, like getting sick of working for these big hidebound institutions and thinking like, it'd be fun to go out, you know, now if I can make a living without any of those constraints, that's pretty appealing. I mean, the funny thing is, of course, the pendulum then swings back because you also lose colleagues and editors and support and a community when you leave a big institution. And so you're starting to see some of these individual writers say, oh, this is fun, but actually I kind of miss having an editor and I kind of miss having colleagues. And are there ways to recreate that? on these new platforms. And so I do think you sort of see a pendulum that's always swinging around this stuff in journalism.
So you may have partly answered the question as to why there isn't a Ben Smith newsletter. I know it's been offered to you, and you're a big name in journalism, and I'm sure you could command one of these gigantic Substack advances that I keep reading about. So why didn't you do it?
I'm enjoying working for the New York Times. Honestly, mm-hmm. I really love having great editors. But I would say I do think that, you know, a lot of journalists are really more interested in the stuff they cover than they are in themselves and their own voices. I'd rather sort of have the option of, you know, of changing my mind and not telling my audience what they want to hear and annoying the people who thought that they agreed with me because I've come to some different conclusion or found something different or wandered in a different direction. And I do think that one thing about when you become a brand or a franchise or sort of your own thing is that you can become captive to the audience that you build. And it's kind of a luxury to work for a big institution where you don't have to be that.
That's so weird. I mean, it's kind of counterintuitive and different from what we just said, too, which is that people are going to newsletters because they can say whatever they want and they can be flamethrowers. But you're saying, well, no, you just have a different set of bosses. In this case, it's your base. It's your subscription base.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's true in all subscription businesses. And it's a bit of a luxury to work for a place where it's like, you know what, sorry, I totally disagree with everybody reading me and screw you, right? Like that's a real luxury that I enjoy.
I mean, the other interesting tension is between the idea of it being the Wild West and people who, I mean, Substack, because they seem willing to take on people who have some scratches and dents in their reputations or who have said things that other people find unpalatable. So the question is, like, what is Substack? I mean, you mentioned, I think, Roxane Gay didn't like some of the transgender stuff that other people at Substack might have said or written. So, but is it the same? It's not really the same as my colleague at the newsroom of the New York Times or the Washington Post has has said or done these things which I find unpalatable and disruptive to staff harmony and that kind of stuff. I mean, there is no set of colleagues at Substack, except that if you're at Substack and there's somebody there that you think is some freaking crypto Nazi, you know, should that bother you? And it seems like some of the writers are struggling with that question.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's a hard question in any institution you work, like how much, particularly in media, you know, how much does the worst thing that's written on the website that day, how much do you kind of own it and how much does it reflect on you? I think there's a reality that we all sort of need to come to grips with, that you just have no control on the internet. There is a new set of platforms where anyone can make a living writing for an audience that enjoys their work. And whether you want them to not, it just doesn't matter at all. Like, you have no control. It's not, you know, they can get banned from the big social media platforms, doesn't matter. With all the good and all the bad that comes from that sort of opening up, like although it is also different from the earlier version of this in that they are really, people are talking directly to their own audience. It's not really playing out on social media. It's not playing out in big public feuds. It's playing out in kind of more private, kind of contained conversations. But I do think that all these arguments over, there are a lot of arguments around what is sort of the boundary of acceptable speech. And I think, you know, there's no institution that can set those boundaries anymore. And so the arguments are a little bit pointless.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you for doing this. This is fascinating stuff. And I am a big fan. Ben Smith is media columnist for The New York Times and the founder and former editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News. We're going to come back with an interview that was recorded yesterday, actually, with Heather Cox Richardson, who's an example of a newsletter writer who really gets you away from the rattle and hum of the Beltway or of New York City. You can almost hear the silence of her main peninsula, the occasional foghorn or buoy puncturing it as she writes about current affairs. So we'll come back with her after this.
Read my letter once again. Open your heart, let me come in. Don't hold back your foolish pride.
So now that we sort of talked a little bit about the landscape of newsletters, let's talk about a specific one. That's what we're going to do for the rest of the show. And we're going to talk to somebody who is probably, given her general demeanor, uncomfortable with labels like breakout star of the newsletter world, but she is. Heather Cox Richardson is a professor of history at Boston College. She's the author of many books, including How the South Won the Civil War, Oligarchy, Democracy, and the Continuing Fight for the Soul of America. And she writes the newsletter Letters from an American. In fact, either you know exactly who she is and, you know, and open her newsletter first thing in the morning, or you're about to probably become that kind of person. So first of all, welcome to our show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So we should, first of all, just have you describe in a thumbnail what your newsletter is.
My newsletter is actually started as a series of Facebook posts, and I actually post every day on Facebook the same material that I post in the newsletter. So the newsletter is an attempt to take a look at the state of American democracy every single day. But I do it from the perspective of a historian, not as a political journalist or as a politico myself. So I have a bit of a different perspective. I tend to see longer trends. I tend to miss the shiny objects and go for the longer changes that maybe only a political historian with 30 years experience can see.
Right. I mean, that's, you've described the strength of the newsletter. I think that you do miss the shiny object, that in fact, as now a pretty longtime reader of your newsletter, I feel as though what I'm about to get is somebody thinking really hard in a very long form about whatever's happening right at this moment. You know, and it is, there's a voice to your newsletter that is very, very distinct, and a purpose to your newsletter that I think is very distinct from any of the other political newsletters I read or can even think of. So I guess maybe the one of the things I want to ask you a little bit more about is, we were just talking before we started recording this about the intimacy, about the relationship with the reader that you have with the newsletter. It's not like writing a book. It's not like other kinds of print journalism, at least not in my experience. There's some way in which, because it's a letter that you're sending to somebody, it feels different. And maybe you could say a little bit about how you feel about that relationship with the reader.
It's an interesting relationship because, for me especially, because I grew up with a mother who wrote letters constantly. And I have always written letters. I grew up in the country and, you know, phone calls were really prohibitively expensive. And my best friends and I wrote voluminous letters to each other pretty much every single day. And in fact, it's really pretty much how I make sense of the world. I often describe things to myself in words simply because that's the way we used to communicate. So it's a, and anybody who was ever on the receiving end of my private letters recognizes that that's always been, for all the fact that I've written a bunch of books and all that, that's always been where, you know, my sense of humor came out and I made sort of the smarter observations that I didn't really dare to put enshrined permanently in a book. So for me, it's a continuation of my life and my observations. The funny thing about it for me, though, is, of course, two things. One is that when I write, and when I began writing, I wrote the newsletter not deliberately. I certainly had never even heard of a newsletter when I began. I simply answered people's questions on my Facebook page. And then that grew very, very rapidly. And then it turned into people saying, you know, couldn't you please send this to people through email so they don't have to go on Facebook? And then all of a sudden there was a newsletter. And so the funny thing to me is that I still sit at the same desk with the same computer when I used to write to, you know, four people. And now I'm writing to many, many, many times that. And there's this funny thing where I sit down sometimes at night and I think, oh, yeah, I really don't dare to say that. And I think, well, I would say that to my friends. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do, as opposed to thinking, oh, I've got to write to a specific audience now. And so there's a weird intimacy and also, I don't know, almost privacy to it. I don't know. It is very, very different than writing a piece for any kind of national or international media, and very different than writing a book as well.
I love that thing you said about you would say that to your friends. There's a thing that you do. We were talking before we recorded this about, I am teaching a political journalism class right now, and I did, in fact, do a segment on newsletters, and we did, in fact, read your newsletter. One thing that really struck my students, and they liked it a lot, I think they probably only saw one example of it, is there are these moments. I mean, it's a punishing schedule, what you're doing right now, and there are times when, in a state of obvious exhaustion, you will just sort of say, nope, going to bed, and then there's usually this pristine bucolic main photograph that goes up there in place of your newsletter. My students loved that, and I think they loved it because there was something very real about it. Like, I just can't do it. I'm going to bed. Maybe you can say a little bit more. I'm guessing your readers love it too, even if they're a little disappointed not to get their fix of you.
So first of all, I do it every day and have since the beginning. And everyone's like, take days off. And I don't think people understand. I'm going to write it whether or not I send it out, because I write every single day just because that's what I do. It is a very, when you say grueling schedule, that's the other thing I think people don't realize. Sometimes those pieces take about 10 hours and I have a full-time job. So I don't start it until about 8 o'clock at night. So that's why sometimes I post at 4 or 5 in the morning, is it's taken that long. But what happened was, we were on vacation right before COVID, seems a long time ago now. And there was one night we'd been hiking all day, and you know, my partner was asleep and I was sitting there in the hotel chair trying to write. And I'm like, I can't, in the course of this, I've literally fallen asleep sitting up. And I just happened to take a decent picture. We were in Utah that day and I just threw it up being like, this is what I'm doing. Sorry, give me a break. People loved it. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that, well, I might not need a break from writing. Other people needed a break from reading. So after that, I started to incorporate photographs.
We're talking to Heather Cox Richardson right now, who writes one of the most successful and widely read political newsletters in America, if not the most. You know, I wanted to say one more thing about your writing schedule, which is that I not through any calculation, but I think one of the odd benefits of it is that because, for example, if you're a fan, an HCR fan, as I am, one of the things you like is that the May 3rd newsletter you get on May 4th because you file it so early in the morning. But that also means it's the first thing in a lot of people's inboxes. I know for me, you know, if I look at today's inbox, you will be the first thing in the inbox because it got filed around 1 in the morning when the day was new. And in a way, I think that really gives you an odd kind of primacy in people's inboxes.
I think that's right. And of course, it was entirely inadvertent. It was only that because I couldn't start till after I'd finished my day job. That's just the way things happen. But I'll tell you something that I realized the other day, and I've not so said this to anyone before, and that's that, you know, I read or I write all the time. I've always been that way from the time I was a little kid. And I used to get incredibly frustrated with cereal boxes because they would have, like, you know, the nutritional information and maybe when you were a kid, some fun facts or something on the back. But there was no pattern to them. And I always used to say when I was like a teenager, early 20s, what we really needed to do was to get together with a cereal company and just run a long-standing story across the back of cereal boxes so that every time you picked up a new cereal box, you'd have the next installment of the story. And it hit me just the other day that essentially, while I'm not putting these things on a cereal box, at this point, that's what it is. This is really not about me. It's really about a lot of people coming together to think about what America should be. And by reading these, we're all sort of participating in this ongoing story and very curious about how it's going to come out, but it's almost a make your own story and you get to decide that. So quite inadvertently, I seem to have managed to make the cereal box fantasy come true without the cereal box.
Yeah. If Charles Dickens had thought about that, he would have had David Copperflakes or something, you know, installments that you could read on cereal boxes. So, you know, you said something which I'm going to push back on a little bit, which is I think you used the phrase something like how America should be. I guess I don't necessarily pick up, maybe I'm missing it, the idea that you're trying to tell us how America should be. I don't feel like it's that prescriptive. I think it's more descriptive. I don't know, but now you can push back at me.
Well, I'm not sure we're pushing back. I think maybe it's important for me to define what I mean when I say the way America should be. I am firmly committed to the Enlightenment concept that so long as we make arguments based in fact, and with all the theoretical caveats to that, yeah, you know, you can't ever really, you know, Schrodinger's cat and all that. But I do believe you can approach an approximation of what actually happened. And so long as you're making arguments based in fact, that people will choose the better option of those two things. So I'm absolutely committed to putting facts in front of people. I am not committed at all to how they come out with what they want to do with those facts, because I believe in people. I believe in democracy. And that's the other piece of what I try to do, is that I am firmly committed to American democracy, with the idea that, you know, sometimes people think, oh, you know, she's an American exceptionalist, she's rah-rah America. I am rah-rah America in a really big way, but that does not mean I don't understand that we have never lived up to our potential. In fact, if you read any of my books, you know, especially the last one is really about how much our concept of freedom has depended on unfreedom for people of color and women. But I do believe that the concept, the theoretical concept of democracy, is the form of government most likely to enable people to determine their own fate. So when I say telling people how the world should be, that is absolutely not about a political party today. People keep trying to put me into a political party today. And I'm like, it doesn't fit. This just, these concepts just don't fit. You know, if you want me to talk about theories about conservative history, liberal history, you know, progressive history, socialist history, I can do all of those things, but that's not what I'm trying to do in this newsletter. So when I say the way the world should be, that is, I want Americans to make arguments based on facts again.
Yeah, I want to just respond to that and then ask you one last question. I mean, one of the things that I've sort of, you know, when you it's interesting, I've been a working journalist since 76. I teach occasionally. When you teach, you have to think about much more about what it is you've been doing. And the phrase that I keep coming back to this year, to probably the exasperation of my students, is a grasp of reality. Would this particular journalist, would this particular journalism, would this particular form of journalism give you a better or worse grasp of reality? Which, oddly enough, isn't a question journalists ask themselves very often, but it's sort of ultimately the question. And I think your newsletter, Heather Cox Richardson, gives people a really good grasp of reality. My question, my final question is, how long are you going to keep going? There was one point where you were definitely committed to 100 days into the Biden presidency. That famously has come and gone. How are you feeling about the long march?
You know, it's funny you say that, because there is no doubt that I've got to find a better working relationship with this newsletter, simply because, you know, I'm 58 years old. You know, my partner and I would like to travel, and it is a schedule that is really unthinkable. That being said, there are a lot of people who now depend on this, and I do think it serves a really important function right now in American society. So my answer to that is going to be that this grew organically. I never intended to write this newsletter. It really was, I got stung by a yellow jacket and I'm allergic. So I was observing the reaction and started, I was like literally sitting there at the table, not wanting to move around, and started answering questions for people on Facebook. That to me sounds like a pretty organic start. And it is my sense that this will die or it will change organically in the same way that it began organically. But I don't know what that's going to look like. I had originally thought that it was going to be immediately after Biden, after Biden's 100 days. But of course, I didn't foresee the January 6th insurrection, or the fact that the Republican Party currently is refusing to accept that a Democrat is president. And again, I point again to our American democracy. This is absolutely unprecedented, and it is phenomenally anti-democratic. And because I would like very much to protect democracy, I guess I'll keep writing as long as people are in the game with me trying to do the same.
All right. Well, first of all, that's the second appearance that Yellow Jackets have made on our show this week. But Heather Cox Richardson, it's so great to talk to you. Letters from an American is one of the most influential and certainly popular newsletters in America. Great to actually hear your voice on our show.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Got down on my knees, grabbed my pen and bowed my head. Tried to summon all that my heart finds true and send it in my letter to you.
And we're back. I'd like to say thanks to Kat Pastor. She's our technical producer. She's here in the studio. The senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show is Betsy Kaplan, who is also the producer of this episode. And she wants you to know that there's sort of a Betsy Kaplan, Zack Snyder director's cut of the Heather Cox Richardson interview. It's like 4 hours long, and Wonder Woman dies. And anyway, that we're going to put that up on the website at WNPR.org/Colin or something. Anyway, that'll be on the webpage for this show if you want to go long with Heather Cox Richardson. Meanwhile, time to talk to two more of our favorite newsletter writers. These are both newsletters to which I subscribe. Gabe Fleischer is the author of the newsletter Wake Up to Politics. He's currently a student at Georgetown University. Isaac Saul is a journalist whose work has appeared in Time Magazine, HuffPost, and on CNN, among others. He's the author of the newsletter Tangle. We want to just maybe begin by having each of them describe the newsletter that they produce. Isaac, why don't you go first, tell people what Tangle is.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on, Colin. Tangle is essentially a newsletter that summarizes the best arguments from the right and left on what the news of the day is. So, you know, typically there's a big political story today. That story is about Liz Cheney's fractures with the Republican Party. And so when you open Tangle, you'll see a quick summary of that story and then the left's perspective, the right's perspective, and then my take. And that's sort of like the heart of the newsletter. There are a few other things in there. You know, I answer a reader question and do a roundup of some cool numbers from the last 24 hours and those kinds of things. But usually it's about sort of showing people some views from across the political spectrum on whatever the big debate of the day is.
Yes. And one of the reader questions that you had to answer several times is where the why the left is called the left and the right is called the right. But we don't have time to go into that right now. Get Tangle if you want to find that out. So, yeah, just maybe say a little bit more about, I mean, first of all, I find this, one of my students actually discovered this and kind of turned me on to it, this, and Gabe's, as far as that goes, too. And I find this is a really, really useful thing. I'm surprised. In some ways, I'm kind of surprised that nobody else has thought about doing this before. You really sort of take the problem, which is polarization and siloing, and it's kind of vaccinate against it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I came to doing this work from growing up in a really politically divided place in suburban Pennsylvania and having a lot of friends and family who I just saw constantly talking past each other. And then sort of on the other side of that as a journalist, realizing that, you know, whenever I went and published a story, you know, if I wrote something for Huffington Post or I wrote something for Fox News, it was going to immediately be dismissed by half the country based on where it was being published. And so I kind of had this dream of like, let's just be open about the fact that people have biases and reporters have biases and opinion columnists have biases. And just say, that's okay, but we're going to show you, you know, a balance of those views all in one place. You can kind of just engage with the full spectrum of ideas that are out there. And, you know, frankly, I didn't know if it was going to work. I mean, the country is very divided and places like, you know, your Fox News or CNN, they do well in an era of polarization. And so, you know, I was uneasy about how it would go, but the response has been incredible. And it's very clear to me that there is a huge segment of the American population that really wants this. Hmm.
So both of you are kind of celebrating major anniversaries or career events right now. We'll come back to Isaac for his in just a second. But Gabe, you're celebrating the 10th anniversary of Wake Up to Politics, which is weird because you're 19.
That's right. Yeah, I started the newsletter when I was about 9 years old for my first subscriber, who was my mom. And I've been doing it for about 10 years now and about 50,000 readers. And I'm kind of like Isaac, also Wake Up to Politics. It's kind of focused on summarizing the day's biggest news kind of in a way that's concise, but also comprehensive and kind of full of context. And, you know, and just tries to do it also like Isaac in kind of a whereas Tangle is maybe bipartisan, I try to do it in kind of a nonpartisan fashion without kind of any opinion or just kind of, you know, giving kind of just the facts.
Yeah. So why do you think your subscribers are your subscribers? In other words, what would attract them to you? There are a lot of political newsletters out there. What is it that you're doing that you think is special to them?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess I would say I think one big thing is just the style that I try to write in. You know, obviously, I'm 19, so I think I come at journalism with a bit of a different perspective than most kind of professional journalists. So I just try to write in a style that's very simple, that just tries to explain things, doesn't assume that people already know, you know, the entire backstory of a certain news event. I just try to kind of walk people through it and explain it in really simple terms, but also in a way that is comprehensive, which is why I'm really proud that my audience spans from, you know, students in middle school and high school, even younger than me, as well as political professionals, members of Congress, their staffs, people in the White House. And so there's really is this kind of wide span, and I try to write for them all, just kind of in a way that's simple and makes sense, but also adds value so people can really understand what's going on.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, and this will bring us back to Isaac also, who's had a different kind of career experience or career arc. But you, some people looking at you, like maybe even me looking at you, I'm thinking, well, you know, I learned a lot about what I know about journalism working in a newspaper newsroom for a lot of years when I was starting out, you know, and there's kind of an apprenticeship process that goes on and some mentoring, both good and bad mentoring that you get in that situation. You haven't had the benefit of it or even really had a window for it since you started at the age of 9 and you're 19 now. Do you ever think about that? Ever think about sort of what maybe you would know that you don't know if, in fact, you don't ever work in a situation where you have sort of older colleagues who might be telling you stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, look, I don't pretend to know everything about journalism. Certainly, I have so much to learn and a lot to learn. I have been lucky to, you know, not in a newsroom setting, but learn from a lot of, you know, other journalists. I'm from St. Louis, so, you know, journalists, the kind of in the local media that where I kind of came up in, and then also now that I'm here in Washington from other journalists that I've gotten to know. So I certainly have a lot to learn. I guess I will say, though, you know, what I've learned is you can learn a lot. I think there's a lot to be learned in journalism school. There's a lot to be learned in a newsroom. There's also a lot to be learned just by doing it. And, you know, I've been doing it, like I said, for 10 years now. My newsletter predates Substack. It predates Axios or Punchbowl or a lot of the other newsletters that are out there. I've just kind of been doing it for 10 years now. And I think little by little, you know, I've learned a lot just, and I've grown a lot, certainly as a writer, just by every morning waking up and trying to do the best that I can. And little by little, I think it's been a huge source of growth. But certainly I have a lot to learn. And I think there's a lot of different ways to gain experience.
Oh, yeah.
To gain that kind of knowledge.
And I think this, you know, the experience that you're having parallels what was going on in blogging 20 years ago. And a lot of the bloggers who rose up and became incredibly popular national bloggers would say at the time, you know what the difference between me and a journalist for The New York Times is? A paycheck. They get a paycheck. I don't. But other than that, they don't have any qualifications that I don't have. And I think one of the things people do come to understand about journalism is if you're smart and purposeful and accurate and dedicated and courageous, you probably do pretty well at it. So Isaac, you're celebrating kind of an anniversary, not an anniversary, but you're disentangling from your other job to be full-time Tangles. Say some more about that.
Yeah, I mean, today is literally my last day at a job that I've been at as an editor for 7 years. So it's pretty awesome to be on the show talking about it. I mean, I have basically, you know, been in the political journalism space for 7, 8, 9 years now. I was a journalism major in college and school editor for the school paper. And so, you know, I had that more traditional path, I think, maybe compared to Gabe. But in the last 2 years, I've been writing this newsletter pretty much every day, Monday through Friday. And it's grown substantially to the point where, you know, the economics of it are simply better. And I enjoy the process of putting together the daily newsletter more than I enjoy sort of the daily drumbeat of what I was doing as a political reporter, as a freelancer. And so, you know, I think for the last year and a half, 2 years, I've been doing both at the same time and sort of seeing what it's like next to each other. And there's something really special about having your own platform that's yours, that is, you know, not, I guess, chained down by the reputation of wherever you're publishing your work. I mean, I'm bringing something that's like a very fresh brand and a fresh look to people. So the only thing that really matters is my writing and the arguments that I'm making. And that is like a really, really appealing space for me to be in. I think, you know, more than being a traditional reported daily news issue, Tangle is a lot more about analysis and breaking down opinion. I mean, there are, of course, elements of journalism and all of that. But for me, it's really about exposing people to this broad view of opinions that exist across the United States and frankly, across the world. I mean, we have readers in 40 countries outside the US who are just interested in American politics and interested in our format. So it's a huge day for me. I mean, this is actually a really, really special day for me. It feels really good to be at a place where I can go in and do this full time. And I think that kind of speaks to the efficacy of this newsletter model that Substack is running and that other newsletters have successfully built on, you know, through ads or whatever else. And I think Ben Thompson sort of calls it being a sovereign writer, which is kind of how I define myself in that I am, it's me and I have some people who help produce the newsletter, but it's my content, it's my piece, and I'm fully independent now, which is a really exciting moment.
Well, yeah, congratulations. So Gabe, you may face a different set of choices, partly because of where you are in your life. You'll graduate from college fairly soon. You already have more readers than a lot of people who are long-serving professional journalists do. So there's, you know, little doubt that you could keep this going for the foreseeable future. Is that what you think you're going to do? Or is there some part of you that wants to take this reputation you've established and see what it's worth to the Washington Post or BuzzFeed or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I'm only a freshman right now, so I feel like I do have some time to kind of decide, and I don't know exactly kind of where my path will take me. But I will say, you know, I think a few years ago, probably my answer would have been, you know, that I'd rather kind of go to the Times or the Post or some other news outlet if they would take me and kind of join a larger outlet. But I think, like Isaac said, you know, I think the rise of Substack has shown, even though I'm not on Substack, but kind of the growth of newsletters there has shown that it really is a viable option. You know, if you have a large enough platform and an audience that is willing to support you, you know, it's something you can do kind of full time. And I love that description, sovereign writer. I think it's really special if you're able to kind of build kind of independent platform and people that kind of trust you and kind of separate from any other brand. So I think a few years ago that would have seemed like a pipe dream, but now it very much seems like a possibility. And if I can, it is something I'd love to do kind of long term, just continue building kind of my own platform and see where it goes.
All right. So ironically, I want to ask you guys questions about time, and I only have 3 minutes and, you know, 45 seconds left in the whole show. But, you know, I do think, you know, even talking to my undergraduate students, they like both of your newsletters, partly because they can get through them really quickly. They also read something called The Skim with two M's. Isaac, one of the things you do is you post, as does, I think, Axios, you post estimated reading time, how long it's going to take to get through all this. Are you kind of aiming at a demographic that's thinking, I don't have all day to master this particular aspect of reality?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's actually almost kind of the inverse of that, which is, you know, I am advertising and positioning myself as a place where you're going to go a little bit deeper on the news than you might in just a platform like The Skim. You know, I'm saying if you give me 10 or 12 minutes of your time, then you won't have to read or watch anything else for the rest of the day. Like you're going to get these quick hits and you're going to get a deep dive on this one major issue where you're going to learn a lot and you'll see all the views out there. And this way, you know, you don't have to read through the Wall Street Journal and Fox News and the New York Times and the Washington Post just to try and get to something that sort of resembles, you know, a truth or middle ground or holistic position. It's just like this one thing will do it. And I do get a lot of positive feedback about people saying that they appreciate the time at the top of the newsletter, but most are a 10 to 12 minute read, which is, I think, a lot longer than, you know, the Axios or the Skim even Gabe's newsletter.
Right. So the only problem with that, Isaac, is I read your newsletter every day. I never have any idea what Doug Emhoff is doing. I have to read Gabe to find out where is Doug Emhoff? What is he doing right now? So Gabe, I actually have a minute left. Could you just talk about that? I found my students also liked the fact that they could get a pretty good snapshot of what's going on by reading you, and it didn't take that long.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say staying concise. It is a big focus of mine. You know, the New York Times actually called me the anti-Skim. So I do like to think that I do give some context and go a little deeper too. But, you know, I think a special thing about the newsletter format is, you know, people kind of build you as part of their daily routine. So I kind of, my hope is, you know, people wake up with their cup of coffee or if they have to get off to work, they're reading the newsletter. And then my hope is, yeah, you kind of whatever you need to know about American politics the rest of the day, you can find it in kind of a quick snapshot, including, like you mentioned, what all our leaders are doing. Isn't something you can find in many other outlets, but I have it every morning right at the end, what each branch of government is doing. So you can kind of have a good glance at what's ahead, and then you can go on with the rest of your day and read again tomorrow.
All right. So wake up to politics. That's Gabe Fleischer. Isaac Saul does Tangle. I hope this show has made you maybe think about dipping your toes into the waters of newsletters if you have not already. Thanks again to Betsy Kaplan and to Kat Pastor and to you for listening.